Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Thank you for joining us for the October 14th, Thursday edition of the Fort Collins Coloradoan. My name is Magna Call. Today we will be reading the following main articles. U.S. set to reopen land borders in November. Written by Zeke Miller and Elliot Spaggett. Colorado sees wild weather with system that moved in. Written by Miles Blumhardt. Borrowers denied student loan relief get second look. Written by Colin Binkley. Agency urges bigger push to cut emissions. Written by David McHugh. And following up with miscellaneous articles. U.S. set to reopen land borders in November. Fully vaccinated travelers will be allowed to cross. San Diego. Beleaguered business owners and families separated by COVID-19 restrictions rejoiced Wednesday after the U.S. said it will reopen its land borders to non-essential travel next month, ending a 19-month freeze. Travel across land borders from Canada and Mexico has been largely restricted to workers whose jobs are deemed essential. New rules will allow fully vaccinated foreign nationals to enter the U.S. regardless of the reason, starting in early November, when a similar erasing of restrictions is set for air travel. By mid-January, even essential travelers seeking to enter the U.S., such as truck drivers, will need to be fully vaccinated. Shopping malls and big-box retailers in U.S. border towns whose parking spaces had been filled by cars with Mexican license plates were hit hard by travel restrictions. San Diego Mayor Todd Gloria said the economic impact was hard to quantify, but can be seen in the sparse presence of shoppers at a high-end outlet mall on the city's border with Tijuana, Mexico. The decision comes at a critical time ahead of the holiday shopping season. In Del Rio, Texas, Mexican visitors account for about 65% of retail sales, said Blanca Larson, executive director of the Chamber of Commerce and Visitors Bureau in the city of 35,000 people. Along the border, we're like more of one community than two different communities, she said. Fully vaccinated U.S. citizens and permanent residents have been allowed into Canada since August, provided they have waited at least 2 weeks since getting their second vaccine dose and can show proof of a recent negative COVID-19 test. Mexico has not enforced COVID-19 entry procedures for land travelers. The latest move follows last month's announcement that the U.S. will end country-based travel bans for air travel and instead require vaccination for foreign nationals seeking to enter by plane. The new rules only apply to legal entry. Those who enter illegally will still be subject to expulsion under a public health authority that allows for the swift removal of migrants before they can seek asylum. Travelers entering the U.S. by vehicle, rail, and ferry will be asked about their vaccination status as part of the standard U.S. Customs and Border Protection inspection. At officers' discretion, travelers will have their proof of vaccination verified in a secondary screening process. Unlike air travel, for which proof of a negative COVID-19 test is required before boarding a flight to enter the U.S., no testing will be required to enter the U.S. by land or sea, provided the travelers meet the vaccination requirement. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the U.S. will accept travelers who have been fully vaccinated with any of the vaccines approved for emergency use by the World Health Organization, not just those in use in the U.S. That means that the AstraZeneca vaccine, widely used in Canada, will be accepted. Mexico, Canada, and elected officials from U.S. border regions have pressured the Biden administration for months to ease restrictions. Colorado sees wild weather with system that moved in. The weather system that rolled into Colorado this week produced a wild array of weather around the state, with the National Weather Service in Boulder issuing a tornado warning, high wind warning, red flag warning, winter storm warning, winter weather advisory, and freeze warning, all in the same 24-hour period. Fort Collins did not receive any snow, but did record 0.11 inches of precipitation, according to the Colorado Climate Center. That moisture came in the form of rain, small hail, and grapple, and was accompanied by thunder and lightning. The mountains picked up their first significant snow of the season. The southern mountains picked up the most snow, with some places reporting more than 6 inches. The storm track moved north, creating blizzard warnings that continued until noon Wednesday in places like Torrington, Wheatland, and Douglas in Wyoming, according to the National Weather Service in Cheyenne. The weather led to the closures of parts of Colorado's Interstate 25 and U.S. Highway 287 overnight Tuesday into Wednesday. The Colorado Department of Transportation closed northbound U.S. Highway 287 at Ted's Place to the Wyoming border Tuesday night into Wednesday morning due to adverse conditions. Northbound Interstate 25 also closed between Exit 278, Colorado Highway 1, and Exit 281, Owl Canyon Road, due to safety concerns. Both routes reopened later Wednesday. Trail Ridge Road in Rocky Mountain National Park also closed due to adverse conditions and remained closed as of Wednesday afternoon. Another system moves into the area Thursday. According to the National Weather Service forecast, Fort Collins has a 60% chance of rain-snow mix Thursday with no snow accumulation expected. Thursday's low is forecast to be 29 degrees, Friday's low, 30 degrees, and Saturday's low, 33 degrees. Borrowers denied student loan relief get second look. Part of settlement from suit brought by teachers. Thousands of public servants who were rejected from a student loan forgiveness program will get their cases reviewed by the Education Department as part of a new settlement in a lawsuit brought by one of the nation's largest teachers' unions. The settlement that was announced Wednesday aims to resolve a 2019 suit accusing the department of mismanaging its public service loan forgiveness program, a troubled initiative that the agency is separately working to expand through an overhaul announced last week. The suit was brought by the American Federation of Teachers on behalf of 8 members who said they were wrongly denied debt cancellation through the program. Created in 2007, the program promises that college graduates who take jobs in public service can have their federal student loan debt forgiven after making 10 years of monthly payments. But the majority of applicants have been rejected, often for failing to meet complicated eligibility rules. According to the lawsuit, the Education Department routinely made errors while processing applications, yet offered no appeals process. The suit, which argued borrowers were illegally being denied their right to due process, targeted the department and former Education Secretary Betsy DeVos. As part of the settlement, the department said it would automatically review applications for all borrowers who were rejected prior to November 1, 2020, as long as they had made 10 years of payments. If the department finds that a rejection was justified, it will email borrowers to explain the decision and how they can become eligible. It goes a step further than a temporary expansion announced last week, which allows some previously ineligible borrowers to get loan forgiveness if they submit an application by the end of October 2022. A separate appeals process will be created by April 30th, 2022, for anyone whose application is denied. All 8 plaintiffs in the suit will also get their loan balances erased, estimated at nearly $400,000. Randy Weingarten, president of the AFT, called it a game-changing victory for educators, nurses, and other public workers who were wrongly rejected. Among the plaintiffs is Debbie Baker, an Oklahoma teacher who made 10 years of payments before learning she had a type of loan that isn't eligible under the program's rules. She will now get more than $80,000 in student debt erased. To be defrauded like that is not right, especially during a pandemic when I've been teaching in person every day, she said in a statement. Now, this settlement finally makes things right. Some other plaintiffs said they were incorrectly told by their loan servicers that they were eligible for the program, only to find out later that they had an ineligible loan or repayment plan. They also will see their loans cleared. Last week, the Education Department announced it will temporarily lift some rules to expand eligibility while it works on permanent improvements. Agency urges bigger push to cut emissions. Frankfurt, Germany. The International Energy Agency is urging governments to make stronger commitments to cut greenhouse gas emissions at an upcoming UN climate summit, warning that the world is not on track to meet environmental goals and that the new investment in clean energy is needed to jolt the energy system into a new set of rails. The IEA said Wednesday in its annual World Energy Outlook that great strides have been made to move away from fossil fuels by relying on more wind and solar energy, while electric vehicles are setting sales records. But the economic rebound from the pandemic also has seen an increase in the use of coal and oil, the report said, as well as a leap in emissions. Burning fossil fuels produces carbon dioxide, the main greenhouse gas that scientists blame for climate change. The world's hugely encouraging clean energy momentum is running up against the stubborn incumbency of fossil fuels in our energy systems, said Faith Birol, executive director of the 30-country IEA. Governments at the summit needed to give a clear and unmistakable signal that they are committed to rapidly scaling up the clean and resilient technologies of the future. The social and economic benefits of accelerating clean energy transitions are huge, and the costs of inaction are immense. The report said the recovery puts strains on parts of the energy system, leading to sharp rises in prices for natural gas, coal, and electricity as worldwide energy demand is set to regain the ground lost last year during the pandemic. Today's obituaries. Georgia Anna Chambers Haley, age 59, October 6th. Larry J. Houston, Bloomington, Illinois, September 30th. Neva M. Lawton, age 74, Fort Collins, October 6th. Ned Stephen Lucero, age 62, Windsor, October 10th. Janice Rogers, age 82, Fort Collins, October 10th. Georgia Anna Chambers Haley. A longtime resident of Fort Collins, Colorado, survived in life by her husband, Mark Haley, with ex-husband Clifford Chambers, Athena M. Chambers, Jeremiah D., and Francis Chambers, Nicholas E. and Cynthia Chambers, and Dustin M. Chambers. She is also survived by her grandchildren, Nevaeh Faith Wright and Carson Chambers. Memorial services will be held October 16th, 2021, at Northside Aztlin, located at 112 East Willow Street, Fort Collins, from 1 to 3 p.m. Please RSVP 619-504-3075. Ned Stephen Lucero, Windsor, passed away on October 10th, 2021, surrounded by family. Steve, born in Greeley and graduate of Windsor High School, was a lover of all things music, a sports enthusiast, and, for most of his life, an athlete. Steve's eclectic music collection was immense, and he loved music of all genres. Steve was a lifelong Bronco fan, an Olympics superfan, and he was unbeatable on the volleyball court. Whether shoulder dancing to a Tina Turner classic, loudly cheering the Broncos from the couch, teaching his nephews or nieces some new athletic feat, or making an aggressive move in a game of aggravation, Steve will always be remembered for the love and laughter he brought to everyone around him. Steve was an organ donor. In death, he was able to donate his eyes, tissue, and skin, demonstrating his immense kindness and consideration of others, even after his passing. Steve is survived by his sisters, Brenda Holland of Windsor, Sandra Brown of Fort Collins, and Glenda Skog, and her husband, Steve Wiley of Albuquerque, and his nephews, Jeremy Skog of Westminster, Scott Brown of Fort Collins, Angel Bice of Windsor, and niece Michaela Brown of Greeley. Steve was preceded in death by his parents, Beatrice and Ned Lucero, and his identical twin, Richard. Funeral services will be held at Faith Church of Windsor on Saturday, October 16th at 10:30 a.m. The family is requesting that in lieu of flowers, those who wish to should make a donation to the American Liver Foundation. So many memories. Family of Alta Vista pioneers look back on a century in Tres Colonias. Written by Aaron Udell. Choke cherry jam. If there's one sense tied to the tiny adobe house at 749 Martinez Street, through the smell of tortillas cooking on a wood-burning stove or the bellowing sound of a passing train's horn would rank high. It's the taste of Rosie Cordova's choke cherry jam. Over her life, Rosie made countless jars of it, pickling the berries from choke cherry trees that flanked her family's home in Fort Collins' Alta Vista neighborhood. She never let anything go to waste, Rosie's daughter Cheryl Cordova recalled, with a chuckle this summer while walking around the home where her mother had lived nearly all her life, from the early 1920s until her 2007 death. Appropriately, about a dozen members of the extensive Cordova family gathered across from Alta Vista at Sugar Beet Park to watch a new chokecherry tree take root Tuesday morning. The tree was underwritten by the Cordovas as part of the city's Living Tribute Trees program and planted in memory of Rosie and the Cordova family in the final days of Hispanic Heritage Month. Though the tree's roots are new to Fort Collins, the Cordovas are anything but. How Fort Collins' Tres Colonias got their start. It's been almost 100 years since Jose Dolores Cordova, his wife Ruth, and their infant daughter Rosie left their home in New Mexico for a new life in Fort Collins. Like others in the area's growing population of Hispanic families at the time, Jose and Ruth were drawn to northern Colorado for jobs, likely in its burgeoning sugar beet fields, Cheryl told the Coloradoan this summer. Jose quickly got to work assembling the adobe bricks for his family's modest one-room home in what is now Martinez Street, according to family stories. Official documentation from that time is sparse, and some more recent surveys estimate the home's construction was closer to 1930. But Cordova lore and a handwritten family document indicates Jose built 749 Martinez Street around 1922, possibly making it one of the first, if not the first, homes of Alta Vista, according to Doug Cordova, a hobbyist family historian and one of Jose's many grandchildren. The adobe walls Jose built are still standing, as are the numerous additions he built over the years to better fit he and Ruth's growing brood of 10 children. Almost a century later, the home never left the Cordova family and is currently owned by one of Jose and Ruth's grandsons. Alta Vista was the third and final Tres Colonias neighborhood to be built, following the little box houses of the Buckingham neighborhood and the evolving assemblage of beat worker shacks in what would become Andersonville. Unlike Buckingham and Andersonville, which were built in the early 1900s by the Great Western Sugar Co. to house the area's German-Russian beet workers, Alta Vista was specifically planned in 1923 as the company's Spanish colony, according to a 2003 historical report by Adam Thomas. Its tidy rows of two-room adobe homes popped up soon after just northeast of Fort Collins's Great Western Sugar Factory. Adobe homes would also be built in Andersonville around that time. In the 1920s, as more families from the southwestern U.S. and Mexico moved to the area for beet work, many settled in the other Tres Colonias neighborhoods, making them a haven for many of Fort Collins's Mexican and Hispanic families. Thomas's report continues. Jose and Ruth did find work in Fort Collins fields, and Jose was listed as a beet tender in the 1930 census. By 1940, 9 of the couple's 10 children had been born, and, like with many others at the time, beet work had become a family affair. Cheryl remembers stories of her grandparents, mom, aunts, and uncles working in the beet fields. Rosie, the oldest, left school after the 5th grade to help care for her younger siblings. Rosie got married and had children of her own. Cheryl said her mother would tell her stories of having to block beet seedlings while pregnant. She would look down and just see unending rows of beets left, Cheryl said. That was hard work. Remembering the Cordovas. After long days working in the beet fields, Doug said he remembers hearing that Jose would have dinner at home before going back out to load trucks at the nearby Great Western Sugar Factory. Slow and steady, Doug said when asked what his grandpa Jose was like. Everyone always said he was slow and steady, and my mother would always tell me, you never would have met a nicer man. My grandfather, he was easygoing, but my grandmother, she ruled the roost. What she said went. She was a little strict with us, Cheryl recalled of her grandparents. After nearly 50 years in Fort Collins, the couple moved to the Denver area, where they spent their final years. Cheryl was just a kid when her grandpa Jose died on New Year's Eve, 1967. Ruth died 17 years later in 1984. Rosie remained in their home on Martinez Street, where she raised her kids with her husband, Philip Cordova. Coincidentally, Philip was part of a different, unrelated line of Cordovas in Alta Vista. To complicate matters, Philip's father was named Jose Dolores Cordova, which was only one letter different from Rosie's father's name, Jose Dolores Cordova. The union resulted in constant confusion over accounts at the local supermarket, so much so that one family had to switch to an entirely different store, according to Rosie and Philip's son, Joe Cordova. It also led to a seemingly endless network of Cordova aunts, uncles, cousins, and grandkids who always used 749 Martinez Street as a gathering spot. Rosie was constantly in her kitchen cooking up stacks of tortillas or a fresh pot of beans, a dish she became so well known for that it got a special mention in her eulogy. Cheryl lived two doors down from her parents for years and remembers visiting every day with her kids to help Rosie cook and clean. Being born in 1921, my grandma taught me how to wash clothes on a washboard in the bathtub, hang clothes on the clothesline, chop wood for her wood and coal stove, said Ashley M. Cordova, Cheryl's daughter. There are just so many memories. The old-fashioned skills Rosie passed down gave Ashley, now 34, a sort of distinction among her peers. They weren't used to the industrious life of Alta Vista and would sometimes go wide-eyed when Ashley told them where she lived. But Ashley's time there has inspired a lifelong love of Alta Vista and a deep fascination in her family's history. In 2017, she helped gather research and materials as part of a successful campaign to get a Fort Collins street named after the Cordovas. This year, her baby became the chokecherry tree, which was planted in honor of her family on Tuesday. The Cordova family tree is on the northeastern side of Sugar Beet Park, steps from the park's new monument called The Hand That Feeds, which honors the sacrifices of Mexican and Hispanic beet workers like the Cordovas. While the Buckingham neighborhood was annexed into Fort Collins in 1906, Andersonville and Alta Vista remained outside of city limits until their annexation in 1974. As a result, the neighborhoods lacked basic infrastructure for decades, going without a sewer line until the 1970s and without paved roads until 1980, according to Thomas's report. In the mid-1970s, the city allowed residents of the neighborhoods to rename their streets, which had previously just been known by different letters. In time, more change would come in the form of new businesses, like breweries moving into the area, increased traffic, and some of Buckingham's original homes being demolished and overtaken with the modern replacements. Hispanic home ownership in some parts of the neighborhoods dropped by almost half between 1990 and 2014, leaving some of its residents feeling left behind as its economics shifted, according to a 2014 Stanford University study of the area. The adobe homes of early Alta Vista look different than they once did, with renovations over the years that include the addition of pitched wood-framed roofs. But vestiges of the area's early residents remain, especially at 749 Martinez Street. That will likely be the case for a while, as Ashley doubts the home will leave the Cordova family anytime soon. "It will stay in the family," Ashley said. "Somebody in the family would buy it if it were ever to be sold. There's just too much history there." History like the exterior hatch to the home's attic, where Jose and Ruth's sons climbed up to every night to sleep. Or the property's original garage, which Jose built. Rosie's beloved two-toned wood and coal-burning stove that sits stalwartly at the home's backyard. Faded old name labels for Rosie and Ruth Cordova still stuck to the home's mailbox cubby after all these years. And now, across the street in Sugar Beet Park, there's a new chapter of Cordova history as a chokecherry tree settles into its new home. Fact check: is CSU arresting students for being unvaccinated? Written by Molly Bohannon. At Colorado State University, the vast majority of students, faculty, and staff are vaccinated against COVID-19. About 88% of both staff and students are fully vaccinated, according to the university's vaccine dashboard, with nearly 9% of the school's 27,000 on-campus students and 7% of its nearly 8,500 staff members receiving an exemption. But those numbers don't account for all people on campus. The week of September 27th, CSU's Student Conduct Services contacted more than 1,300 students who had failed to submit an exemption request or proof of a COVID-19 vaccination with letters of noncompliance that barred them from returning to campus until their information was submitted. The letter included language stating that if the student was on university property, they could be cited or arrested with trespassing or face further disciplinary action, according to a copy of a letter published by Turning Point USA, a conservative group with a campus presence. On its website, Turning Point posted an image of a redacted letter to a student, informing them of an interim trespass order for not submitting vaccination proof or applying for an exemption. The letter, which has not been verified to be authentic, says the student could be cited or arrested for trespassing and face further disciplinary action if found on campus property. In an October 11th statement to the campus community, CSU said it is not arresting students for not being vaccinated and refuted the claim, calling it a misrepresentation of the university's communication to students. More than 2,400 CSU students are not vaccinated, and they are free to come and go from our campuses as they want, including to attend classes, read the statement. In that statement, CSU said its original communication stated that students who do not provide their vaccine information or declare an exemption are not allowed on campuses until they provide their information, and that coming onto a campus before they provide their information will be considered trespassing by the university. CSU confirmed that the possibility of arrest was mentioned in its original communication to students, adding that the language used is often standard in notices from the conduct office and is not new or unique to this situation of noncompliance with the vaccine or exemption policy. Mike Katz, Director of Student Resolution in the Conduct Office, said that while arrest is a potential outcome of violating trespass orders, for it is not one they want to get to. Katz said they are much more interested in compliance with the policy. As of October 13th, no students had been removed from campus for the orders. Students and staff had about 3 months to submit this data, from the time the vaccine requirement was introduced in May to an August 18th deadline. CSU said that during that period, 7 emails were sent with details on how to navigate the requirement. "We've made the process of submitting information as easy as possible," CSU spokesperson Del Rey Sierravola told the Coloradoan. "Students have received many emails asking them to submit their information since May, as well as several communications since the August 18th deadline to submit information about compliance and the process to share their records." "The process," she said, "is similar to what students go through to share their status regarding other mandated vaccines. Exemptions are given for medical, religious, or personal objections and do not require documentation to be approved. Anyone who receives an exemption is required to receive a COVID test twice a week." After receiving communication from Student Conduct Services in late September, CSU said more than 900 students provided their vaccine information to the university or declared an exemption, adding that most of those students were vaccinated but had simply not taken the steps to provide their status through an online portal. As of October 13th, around 3 p.m., Katz said 382 of the more than 1,300 students who received the notice had not yet submitted their proof of vaccination or a request for a vaccine exemption. "If students who received this noncompliance notice have not taken the appropriate actions to remedy the issue and remain on campus, they can face consequences through the Student Code of Conduct." CSU Volleyball. "Colombo counts on Ram family during pandemic." Written by Kelly Lyle. Sasha Colombo thinks of her mother every time she aces a serve for the Colorado State volleyball team. She wishes she could look up into the stands and see Nicole Colombo's smiling face. It has been nearly 2 years since she has. While her teammates have friends and family members at matches both home and away this fall, Colombo's parents are more than 5,200 miles away, banned from traveling to see their daughter play. Although vaccinated American tourists have been allowed to travel to Italy, Colombo's home country, the U.S., still isn't allowing citizens of Italy and most European countries to travel here, vaccinated or not, because of concerns about the spread of COVID-19. Colombo, a senior middle blocker for the Rams, knew playing college football in the U.S. would present some challenges. but she had no idea how difficult in-person visits with her family, who came to several matches her first 2 years at CSU, would become. Her decision to return home in March 2020, when CSU moved all of its classes online and the Mountain West and NCAA suspended all spring sports activities, including off-season workouts, was probably the hardest moment of my life, she said Monday, before a practice at Moby Arena. Her teammates moved out of their apartments, houses, and campus residence halls to return to their parents' homes throughout the country. And early COVID-19 restrictions turned Fort Collins into a desert town. Adding to her anxiety were the daily reports about how bad the rapidly spreading virus was hitting Italy and her hometown of Milan, in particular. Hundreds of Italians were dying of complications from COVID-19 every day. Hospitals were running out of room to handle the most critically ill patients, and a strict lockdown was in place, requiring government-issued permits to leave the home that were being checked by police in the streets. In case anything bad happened, I needed to be home, she said. After a chaotic 3 days on the phone with the airline companies, scrambling to find a flight home before all international travel to and from the U.S. and Europe was banned, Colombo found a combination of flights over 2 days, with layovers in New York and Germany. That didn't alleviate her fears, though. It simply changed them. It was very scary to even travel, knowing that I could get COVID and then give it to my family, she said. She quarantined for 14 days, as required by Italian authorities, when she arrived home and remembers all you could hear outside was the sound of ambulances. Italian news reports, she said, showed graphs of the daily spikes in COVID-19 cases. The Lombardy province of Italy, where Milan is located, had reported more cases, 844,181, and more than twice as many deaths, 34,093, through Tuesday as any other province, according to the National Health Ministry. Colombo spent more than 2 months at home on the former farm on the outskirts of Milan, where her family and the family of an aunt and uncle each have homes. Her mother and her mother's sister, both British, married two Italian brothers. Me and my older brother and my two cousins were just like a whole gang together when we were growing up, Colombo said. It was great. She has a younger brother, too, now 14. She played basketball with him and helped with his homework while she was home. Colombo stayed in touch with CSU coach Tom Hilbert, and upon learning that the 2020 season was likely to be played as scheduled that fall, made her way back to Fort Collins. With travel from Italy to the U.S. still banned, Colombo and her mother traveled to Turkey and spent 14 days there before she boarded a 13.5-hour flight from Istanbul to San Francisco. She had to quarantine after arriving in Fort Collins and test negative for COVID-19 before beginning summer workouts with her teammates. And then they canceled the season, so I was very disappointed after I did all that just to come back and play, she said. When the Rams finally did play again, in a modified season of Mountain West-only matches last spring, Colombo found herself at a new position. Middle blocker instead of the right side hitter position she played her first 2 seasons at CSU. The move, Hilbert said, was made to provide a bit more organization in the middle. Colombo, he said, is a good volleyball player with a really good, fast arm, capable of playing multiple positions. Colombo has adapted quickly. Her 7 solo blocks are tied for the team lead this fall, and her 42 total blocks are second only to fellow middle blocker Karina Lieber's 45. And she's the Rams' most efficient hitter at .342, with just 22 errors on 155 total attacks, and an average of 1.47 kills per set. I definitely can rely on her, especially with her quick tempo, senior setter Sierra Pritchard said. Lots of teams will underestimate how fast she can actually get the ball, and so I know that if I deliver the ball fast enough, her arm will put that ball on the floor. Her even temperament, never letting her emotions get the best of her on the court, have helped steady the entire team through a rocky start to the season, Pritchard said. After dropping their first three matches, the Rams have won 9 of their past 12 and enter home matches at 7 p.m. Thursday against New Mexico and 1 p.m. Saturday versus Air Force, tied for the MW lead with New Mexico and UNLV, all with 5-1 league records. She's just a very stable mind on the court, Pritchard said. I don't think that she really gets stressed when certain people are watching versus certain people not being there. Sasha plays the way Sasha knows how to play, and she is very strong and able to overcome a lot. Volleyball is what brought Colombo to the U.S., and the CSU team has been like a second family to her, she said. She spent Thanksgiving with assistant coach Emily Cohen and her family, and has traveled home with teammates Jackie Van Leefte to the San Diego area, Brooke Hudson to Houston, and where a planned spring break trip to Arizona was called off as COVID-19 shutdowns began, former teammate Jenna Heinemeier in Parker. I'm not sure I could have done this as easily as I am if I didn't have 15 built-in best friends, Colombo said. I feel like I have a second home here. It definitely feels like my family. Her actual family, though, is still far away. She's able to stay in touch through video chats, phone calls, and text messages. Colombo's mom gets up at 3 a.m. to watch CSU's matches online and stays up to exchange messages with her afterward. I'd say the hardest part is not being able to recognize a familiar face in the stands, like someone that's 100% my family, and they support me through everything, Colombo said. Because my mom has always been my number one fan, she always used to drive me to every single club volleyball game, and she's been there since the beginning. It's a shame that when I do my aces, I always tell her that my aces are for her. I just wish I could look up in the stands and be like, "That was for you, Mom." FDA revises sodium guidance, written by Candace Choi. New York. Food companies are coming under renewed pressure to use less salt after U.S. regulators spelled out long-awaited guidelines aimed at reducing sodium levels in dozens of foods, including condiments, cereals, French fries, and potato chips. The voluntary goals finalized Wednesday for 163 foods are intended to help lower the amount of salt people eat. A majority of the sodium in U.S. diets comes from packaged or restaurant foods, not the salt added to meals at home, making it hard for people to make changes on their own. To get people used to eating less salt, the Food and Drug Administration said reductions have to be gradual and across the entire food supply so that people don't keep reaching for higher sodium options. Over the next 2.5 years, the FDA's target sodium levels aim to cut average intake by 12%, from 3,400 to 3,000 milligrams a day. That would still leave average intake above the federally recommended limit of 2,300 milligrams a day for people 14 and older. But the agency said it will monitor industry progress and keep issuing updated targets. The FDA said it took into consideration industry feedback after issuing its draft guidance in 2016. Ketchup, mustard, and hot sauce, for example, were split up and now have different targets. The final guidance does not spell out a time frame for reaching longer-term targets. Giants-Dodgers get fitting Game 5, written by Bob Nightingale. It just couldn't be any other way. The Los Angeles Dodgers and San Francisco Giants have spent the entire season watching each other, scouting each other, and battling one another. Each team won has 109 games this season, including the postseason. They've played each other 23 times. And now, for the 24th time, Thursday night, they'll go at it for the final game this season in a winner-take-all game. It will be only the fifth winner-take-all postseason game between two 100-victory teams in baseball history, and the first between two teams in the same division. The Dodgers defeated the Giants 7-2 on Tuesday night at Dodger Stadium to force Game 5 of the best-of-five division series, setting up Thursday's matchup at Oracle Park. The winner plays the Atlanta Braves in the National League Championship Series. The loser goes home for a long, painful winter. "This is what baseball wants," Dodgers manager Dave Roberts says. "All the other series are done. We're going to be the only show in town." So, if you have a pulse or you're a sports fan, you better be watching Dodgers-Giants. It's going to be a great one. It has been 59 years since these two teams played in a sudden-death elimination game against one another. But for the first time in their fierce 131-year history, this will be the first true postseason game. The two teams say they will spend their waking hours studying video, poring over scouting reports, churning out analytic studies, but the truth is that they're just wasting their time. Considering this will be their 24th time they'll face one another in the last 146 days, they'll know each other's tendencies all too well. "We know each other's playbook," Robert says, "so it just goes to old school. We're going to run the ball to the right, and you're going to have to stop us. It's the Vince Lombardi style. We know what we do. They know what we do. We know who they want to have the baseball in Game 5. They know who we want and the matchups that we're trying to get. Now it's about going out there and executing, and the best team wins." The reality is that these teams are virtually equal, with nothing that really separates the two. The more they look for differences, the more they are the same. "I think because of the familiarity," Robert said, "we think alike. I think on the margins, trying to get advantages. You know they're carbon copies when they can play all year long against one another and realize that nothing can possibly surprise them. I don't think there's anything in particular that has stood out over the course of this season," Giants manager Gabe Kapler says, "where there was a moment that we learned something. They're such an excellent, balanced team. I think their roster was very well constructed here at the end. It's a difficult team to match up against. Who knows, maybe the slight difference will be the performance of their pitchers, sending two of the finest young starters in baseball to the mound in the biggest game of their lives." The Dodgers will be sending 25-year-old Julio Urias, MLB's only 20-game winner this season, to the mound. The Giants will be countering with 24-year-old Logan Webb, who was spectacular in this game one start, yielding just 5 hits while striking out 10 in the Giants' 4-0 victory. Urias was nearly as brilliant in his game 2 start, yielding 3 hits and striking out 5 in the Dodgers' 9-2 victory. The two teams spent the post-game singing their praises, believing that age is just a number, and convinced their youth won't be a deterrent. "I think his confidence has just continued to grow," Giants all-star catcher Buster Posey said of Webb, who has gone 21 consecutive starts without the Giants losing a game. "The stuff has gotten better because he believes that he has elite pitches that can compete with any lineup. He's shown in the last game of the season, and then in the first game of this series, that he can keep his poise, and I think that bodes well for Thursday." Counter Dodgers all-star right fielder Mookie Betts, "Just seems like Julio has this weird but like old soul about him. He just gets on the mound like he's been there, he's done it. He's got so much confidence in himself that it just kind of oozes out on everyone else." The Dodgers are used to October and refuse to blink no matter how bleak the situation. They won all 3 elimination games last season against Atlanta after being down 3-1 in the NLCS and were tied at two games apiece in the World Series before winning the final two games against the Tampa Bay Rays. "I just think we're best when our backs are against the wall," Dodgers outfielder Chris Taylor said. "And we've shown that. We understand that we still control our own destiny." The Giants, on the other hand, haven't been to the postseason or had a winning season since 2016. They have finished a combined 101.5 games out of first place since that postseason berth. But here they are, winning a franchise record 107 regular season games, with the chance to snuff out the Dodgers. "We know we got a tough task at hand," Giants infielder-outfielder Chris Bryant said, "but it's been pretty special that we've been able to. Just the resiliency that we have and proving people wrong. It's just all come together at the right time, and 107 wins later, we're in this position." They'll play one last time against one another Thursday night in front of a raucous sellout crowd in San Francisco. "This," Posey said, "is why you play." Today in history. Today is Thursday, October 14th, the 287th day of 2021. There are 78 days left in the year. Today's highlight in history. On October 14th, 1947, U.S. Air Force Captain Charles E. "Chuck" Yeager became the first test pilot to break the sound barrier as he flew the experimental Bell XS-1, later X-1, rocket plane over Muroc Dry Lake in California. On this date, in 1964, civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. was named winner of the Nobel Peace Prize. Soviet leader Nikita S. Khrushchev was toppled from power. He was succeeded by Leonid Brezhnev as first secretary and by Alexei Kosygin as premier. In 1981, the new president of Egypt, Hosni Mubarak, was sworn in to succeed the assassinated Anwar Sadat. Mubarak pledged loyalty to Sadat's policies. In 2008, a grand jury in Orlando, Florida, returned charges of first-degree murder, aggravated child abuse, and aggravated manslaughter against Casey Anthony in the death of her 2-year-old daughter, Kaylee. Mountain West Women's Basketball Preseason Poll. 1. Fresno State, 269 points. 2. New Mexico, 251. 3. UNLV, 232. 4. CSU, 207. 5. Wyoming, 190. 6. Boise State, 166. 7. San Diego State, 135. 8. Nevada, 123. 9. San Jose State, 105. 10. Air Force, 62. And 11. Utah State, 42. Sports news in your inbox. With changing print deadlines, we can't always get game coverage for CSU, high school sports, and more in the physical newspaper the next day. But our new NOCO Sports Insider newsletter will deliver the latest sports news to your inbox every day, so you don't miss a thing. Sign up for NoCo Sports Insider at coloradoan.com/newsletters. Thank you for joining us for the Thursday edition of the Fort Collins Coloradoan. My name is Meghna Kaul.
Few people spend as much time in the wilderness and outdoors as hunters and anglers. And a new report aims to be a springboard to bring those conservationists and their knowledge into discussions of combating climate change. The report, titled A Hunter's and Angler's Guide to Climate Change, touches on a variety of landscapes throughout the country used by sportsmen and women that face environmental threats. Among them are the country's forests and rivers. Report author Aaron Kindle of the National Wildlife Federation says in Colorado, heat waves, droughts, and forest fires are hurting outdoor recreation in the state.
If your elk hunt is canceled because the unit that you are going to hunt in is burning down, that's clearly an impact on the ability to hunt. We saw historic closures this year in Colorado. Many rivers closed because of too hot of temperatures for trout. So those are the kind of things we're seeing that are really meaning our ability to hunt and fish is under threat.
Colorado had its first 200,000-acre forest fire in 2020. The report says natural infrastructure can offer some level of protection for these areas. Wetlands, forests, and floodplains in particular can prevent flooding and help purify water. Kindle says some of the immediate actions hunters and anglers can take to start contributing to the fight against climate change include taking part in reforestation efforts. But a big part of finding environmental solutions is by advocating for resources on the state and federal level.
We are a community of storytellers. We talk about the hunt, we talk about fishing, we talk about the seasons and how they've changed. And hunters and anglers have such a crucial narrative that would help shape those pieces of legislation into a better form.
Among the federal support named in the report is the Replant Act, which would quadruple investments in reforestation in national forests. It also suggests relaunching the Civilian Conservation Corps, a 1930s public works program, but with a focus on addressing climate change. I'm Emily Scott with Colorado News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
This is the first key step toward moving our entire freight, transportation, and logistical supply chain nationwide to a 24/7 system.
President Biden announced Wednesday the Port of Los Angeles will begin 24/7 operations to address supply chain bottlenecks. He said the port has nearly doubled its hours of operation. A squeezed global supply chain and a truck driver shortage have led to shortages of computer chips, appliances, and other consumer goods, increasing price tags. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
These commitments will move more goods faster, including toys, just in case you were wondering, appliances, my kids are, and furniture that Americans purchased online or at their local small businesses.
Vice President Kamala Harris met Wednesday with the Prime Minister of Barbados, Mia Mottley, who talked about strengthening the Caribbean region's relationship with the U.S. on climate change, combating drug trafficking, and human rights.
There is much that we can work together on, looking to see where both countries can help each other. We have traditionally provided persons who have come here to work.
The Supreme Court Wednesday appeared poised to reinstate a death sentence for Jahar Tsarnaev, convicted of helping carry out the 2013 Boston Marathon bombings. Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer.
They agreed he was guilty. Their only claim was don't give me the death penalty because it's my brother who is the moving force.
The U.S. Court of Appeals in Boston upheld Tsarnaev's convictions, but ruled his death sentence could be overturned because the trial judge had not questioned the jurors closely enough about their exposure to pretrial publicity and excluded evidence concerning Tamerlan Tsarnaev, his older brother and accomplice. A House committee investigating the January 6th Capitol attack subpoenaed Jeffrey Clark, a Trump ally and former Justice Department employee, who urged its leaders to investigate former President Trump's election fraud claims. Experts say the move indicates the committee's interest in learning more about how Trump attempted to pressure top officials over the election during his final days in office. Dr. Anthony Fauci, President Biden's chief medical advisor, said Wednesday more employers should implement vaccine mandates.
So, I mean, we don't like to be telling people what they need to do with regard to vaccines, but we know that mandates work.
Two new analyses suggest the 2020 census may have undercounted Black Americans at a significantly higher rate than usual, anywhere from 3 to 10 times greater than a decade ago, raising concerns about whether minority communities could lose out on fair representation and funding. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
AINC programming is brought to you in part by WannaBrands, enhancing customers' lives through the responsible use of cannabis.